I'm Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a bi-weekly program where we get behind the scenes in the wine business. The exclusive sponsor of I'll Drink to That is 750, a powerful and easy-to-use online search tool for wholesale buyers of wine and spirits in New York and New Jersey. 750 incorporates over 100 distributor portfolios and a number of unique features that make the lives of buyers simpler and more productive. One of the features I've been most excited about on 750 is the recent introduction of digital tasting books, which allow buyers to access all the pertinent details they need during tasting season right on their own phone. You know how in the past you've had to carry around a heavy, spiral-bound notebook that was a clumsy obstruction to your interaction at the tasting tables? No longer necessary, bro. With 750's digital tasting book feature, you get access to table numbers, pricing, producer name, wine, and everything else you need to make informed buying decisions, as well as your own place to put any tasting notes that you may need to refer to in the future. Digital tasting books, just another way 750 makes the life of a wholesale buyer much easier. Bobby Stuckey on the show today, Frasca Food and Wine. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi. So you live in Colorado now, but you started your career in restaurants in Arizona?
Yep. Yes. Started bussing tables. It'll be 30 years this August.
Wow, because you don't look that old. I mean, you know.
Well, I was somewhat young.
You're the...
Yeah, I was in high school, you know, punk rock, 1983.
Yeah.
Bussing tables. I'm still bussing tables.
But you're the boss now. You had some early mentors in the game?
Yeah, I really did have some early mentors. You know, going back to like even someone I bussed tables for in the mid-80s, a guy named Tom Kaufman, and you can find mentors all along the way, and I hope everyone does. And someone like that, Eric Calderon at the Little Nell Hotel, phenomenal. I mean, I still think about what he and his management team did for me at the Little Nell, and I use that every day also.
And so you started in Arizona, but then you ended up moving to Colorado to work at the Nell in Aspen.
Yes, that was my first journey into Colorado. I went to work at the Little Nell. Started off as the assistant sommelier there, and really Eric Calderon, the GM of the hotel, and the food and beverage director, Connie Thornburg, really were great for me. They gave me a great platform to learn, to work, and to understand hospitality.
And that was a pretty big wine program.
It was. And, you know, and they also really encouraged growth. You know, that was in the mid-90s. And they were all about going after the grand award list and building depth. And to be honest, I think it was easier back then. The price of entry was, sure, it was expensive, but for a hotel or a restaurant to build a wine program wasn't as crazy astronomical as it is now.
Yeah, I agree with you. It seems like that's really changed.
Yeah, I think, you know, from about 2000 on, it just became a whole different game.
Like the benchmarks of a big list are just the goals have moved on those benchmarks in terms of price points, it seems like.
Oh, for sure. I mean, if you used to be able to get a catalog from Chateau and Estates and pretty much reorder vintage Bordeaux, and it was, while it was expensive, it wasn't out of control.
And it had age on it.
It really took a lot of pressures off the restaurants.
And one of the things that is that those kind of holdings of old wine have gone away, it's kind of pushed restaurants to either aging it themselves, which is quite expensive, or just not doing it.
Exactly.
And kind of maybe moving towards cocktails or beer or simple wine lists or something like that.
I mean, there's a lot more well-curated wine lists now that are more, may I say, abbreviated and really tight, but with a lot of exciting stuff. And that's a hard job to do. And we've got some people around the U.S. doing a great job doing that. But seeing those lists where you could go in and say, God, I want to drink some older Barolo, that's sometimes hard to do.
Even in Italy, I feel like that's hard to do.
Oh, for
sure.
You know,
like with real age, you know what I mean? Like
for sure.
80s, 70s, like 2000 you can find.
But, yeah. You know. For a couple of reasons. One, there's not a lot of storage space over there in Italy. And sometimes it's not well stored. I mean, how many times do you have an older bottle of Brunello down in Tuscany and you're like, God, I want to romanticize it that this is great.
But right, right.
Let's be honest. There's a couple hundred degree days that summer.
Right. And they kept it in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Hey, so let's talk about the Aspen scene. I mean, what was that like? What was it like working in Aspen?
Well, Aspen's a lot different than Boulder. I mean, Aspen is a community that is a very international spotlight community. So it was great guests from all over the world. And sure, I think everyone likes to focus on the elitism of Aspen and how expensive it is. But there's a lot of facets that we don't talk about Aspen that makes it so exciting as a sommelier. One, sure, you have people going there skiing or Aspen Food and Wine Classic in the summer, but there's also a lot of intellectual stuff that goes on there. The Aspen Institute, you know, to be able to have, you know, great minds from around the world, if it be a physicist, if it be a classical musician, the Summer Music Festival in Aspen. There's all these things that add to a really interesting fabric as guests, which no one talks about, and that's something I really, really love there.
And what was a normal sale for you at that time? I mean, back then, what was normal to sell?
Wine-wise?
Yeah, was that the Cab Air or the Merlot Air?
You know, it was definitely a time period where in that mid-90s to late-90s, you're starting to see the international spotlight on these small California producers. Back then, maybe if it was Sinequinon or William Saliampino or Colt California Cabernet. And that was when it seemed like the wine buyer, the wine buyer really started paying attention to what journalists were saying, if it be Robert Parker or Tanzer. And that's where the job of the sommelier changed, because you had to be able to really listen to the vibe that the guest was talking to you about their expertise, and decipher that. Like, sure, you might really be into Old Ridge Cabernet, but if this person's coming in and you can tell that they're talking to you about these other blockbuster style Cabernets, it doesn't matter how much you love that Ridge Cabernet, which was a more, and still is, a more older school, moderated style. You had to listen to that and really see where that guest was coming.
You kind of seeing people come in with different knowledge streams at that time, maybe based on what they're reading?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, now look at it. People can just pull it up on their iPhone. But back then, there was an interesting time period where, as a sommelier, you saw the wine buyer change, where they were out looking for that knowledge. They were out looking for their periodical mentor, you know, beyond just the Wine Spectator magazines. You saw people really, if they were really into reading Tanzer or really into reading Robert Parker. And then fast forward to today, people are coming in, which is exciting, I think, and a great challenge for sommeliers. People are really coming in with a lot of information. You can have a guy who's an orthopedist that really studies Burgundy and really spends a lot of time doing that. I don't think we had that as much 20 years ago. I mean, there were some fanatical people, but there's a lot of people that exchange information on the web. And I think that kind of started in the mid to late 90s.
Did you foresee it going in that direction, or was that as kind of a surprise to you, how many people ended up really getting interested in wine?
You know, it kind of happened as we went.
Yeah.
And because I'm someone who was in the profession while it was happening, it didn't catch me totally off guard. But I think if you would have gone back to 15 years ago and say, hey, you're going to walk on the floor now on a Saturday night and you've got this much information, I don't think you would have ever expected it.
And maybe selling kind of more niche items.
Yeah.
From Northern Italy or,
yeah,
you know, that people may not have heard of 15 years ago, even the Grape Variety, let alone the producer.
Oh, for sure. I mean, and also, you live in New York, so it's a little bit different. But for people from the West Coast, I mean, the wine landscape's changed a lot.
What do you see?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm really good friends with Shelley Lindgren at A16.
She's great.
Wow. Awesome. And I think we forget. Okay, let's say when I left the French Laundry 10 years ago to move to Boulder, if you wanted to go out in San Francisco and drink Italian wine, it was hard to do.
Is that true?
For sure.
The North Beach scene was still like kind of cheesy.
Yeah. And it was just, you didn't see that much Italian wine thought. I mean, you could go to Aquarello, mm-hmm. drink some Barolo with age on it, but you didn't have these curated Italian lists. And the sommeliers then, like the group that we were all hanging out with last night,
sure,
a lot of them didn't drink Italian wine then. And Shelley really put the pedal to the metal, and that really changed that city. And, you know, Los Angeles is starting to get there, but really, if you think about 10 years ago, you could drink great Burgundy, great Rhone, great Riesling in San Francisco, but drinking brainy Italian wine wasn't something that they did there. And that's changed a lot, and that's been really exciting.
And we lost one to their team, too, with the David Lynch defection. You know what I mean?
We added it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's kind of swapped, you know, sent one over.
I just saw his, I just went and saw him at St. Vincent 2 weeks ago.
He's such a great guy.
He's one of the one and only.
And so you eventually decided, hey, I'm going to leave Aspen. I'm going to go work at the French Laundry, which is a little known restaurant in Yountville that no one's ever heard of and is not at all lauded or respected. I'm kidding, because obviously it's the opposite of that. One of the most respected restaurants in the world. You were a sommelier there for a number of years, and you also called up a guy named Richard Betts and got him your old job.
Yeah.
What was that time like for you, man? I know it's been a while, but what was that period? What was going on?
Well, you know, I didn't really think. I mean, I loved working at the Little Nell, and then this opportunity came up to go to the French Laundry, and I thought, you know, I'm up for a challenge, and that was what a great challenge, because a lot of people don't realize that the old French Laundry list was all California.
Is that true? I did not know that.
With a small amount of like Negos Burgundy, but I mean like five selections, but it was really a California based list. And Bouchon, which when you took that position at that time, you also wrote the wine list for Bouchon. And at that time, the Bouchon was only California.
That's right.
So my job, it was so exciting. My job was to be the person to put the French Laundry wine list on the same page as the kitchen. An all-world, world-class list. So it was really exciting. I got the opportunity to go in there and to write an all-world wine list. So here, all of a sudden, they'd never had Austria. They'd never had Germany. They'd never had Italy. They'd never had much Burgundy, Rhone, Spain, you name it.
Sure.
And that food was starving for it, you know, especially how the menu was then and still is. That first part of the menu is so white wine and a lot of maybe slightly off-dry white wine friendly, like, which we didn't have access to until we started doing that.
Because there's not a lot of that's made in California.
Yeah, yeah, that's not their skill set. And it was great. So when I took that position, you know, I wanted to make sure the French or the Little Nell had someone great there. And so I told Eric Calderon, you got to call this guy Richard Betts down in Tucson. He's like, really? I said, oh my God, he's going to knock your socks off.
But did you guys know each other well at that point? Or yeah, was that just kind of a faith thing? Or
no, we first became friends in Flagstaff, Arizona, probably the most non-sexy restaurant town. He used to come into a place that I was like the assistant wine buyer waiter at.
Okay.
In like 1993 or 94. And it was this little restaurant in Flagstaff, Arizona, and he and Mona, which is his wife, back then his girlfriend, they would come in every couple weeks when they had a little scratch and buy a bottle of wine and have dinner. And I got to know him. We became really good friends. Go mountain biking together. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you were buddies?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that didn't come out in the Betts interview.
Yeah.
He squashed that part.
Oh, did he?
I was like, well, I mean, why did he call you? And he was like, I don't know. I think he just put seven numbers together and he dialed them on the phone. I mean, it was really like, he didn't say like, there was no, you know, and then Bobby tapped me for this great job, like out of nowhere, like Publishers Clearinghouse. Oh, look, there's a guy with a huge check outside for you. I don't know. It was strange. I never understood. He said you guys went on one bike race. I'm like, you know, I've been on bike races with a lot of guys. I don't remember getting a call later for a job. It's strange. Now I see. Now I understand. So there was a history of him coming in, which he now conveniently forgets. Now these,
oh, you had a lot of Sombra, man. That'll affect your brain
cells. Clos de Bets, we call it Clos de Bets.
Dude, I love that.
You could make a lot of money on that, I think. You know what I mean?
Oh, a little Clos de Bets t-shirt.
Hey, and so, I mean, what was it like working with Keller? I mean, he's one of the most famous chefs in the world.
Well, that was a different era for sure. He and I had the same schedule. So, you know, it was fantastic. I mean, that team there, people hate hearing this, but it was a pretty easy job.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, the hours were hard.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it managerially, I mean, it's a great, like, CEO, corporate culture book could be written. Because at that time period, everybody knew why they were there. You all made a sacrifice to be there. If it be a front of the house person or back of the house person, maybe financially you made a sacrifice, or to your loved one you made a sacrifice because the hours are really intense. But everyone was there for a reason, from the glass polisher all the way up to the chef de cuisine. And it was great. I mean, Thomas had a station. It was great. I mean, it was really, really inspiring. And he really got us to the point of saying, okay, this is what the team is here to do. And he had a really, it was exciting. I mean, I think about, like, my last night there, you had Corey Lee on fish.
Right, sure.
Grant Achatz had just left.
Got it.
You had Rene Redzepi was working in the kitchen.
I didn't know that.
Lachlan, my business partner, was working there. You had Eric Siebold. I mean, just a great, I mean, I think Tim Hollingsworth might have been like, he might have been like on cheese at that point. I mean, it was like such a powered back team, and everyone knew why they were there.
And you think Keller was, or is today, really good at communicating that vision? Or no? I mean, how did that come across? Why did everyone know? Did he set that forth to you?
I think so.
Very,
I
mean, clear. I've only met the man one time. I'm really asking.
I think for sure he knew how to communicate that in his style, that we all knew what we were doing. To the guy who raked, the dishwasher who would come out and rake the pea gravel of the parking lot. Those little details that you don't think of. He got that guy. That wasn't like one of the other managers telling the dishwasher how to do the pea gravel so beautifully. That was Thomas going, like, let's do this really nice. Let's rake this pea gravel really nice. And that was, he doesn't get enough credit for that.
Where do you think that came from? Like, his desire to make it nice. I mean, did he ever talk to you about that? Like, his own inspirations?
I think Thomas, and I'm going to speak for him. I mean, one of the great things about Thomas is it wasn't always Thomas Keller as you know it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here's a guy who, and he's really open about this. Like, and I feel very lucky to have had these experiences. He lost Restaurant Raquel.
Sure.
Then he moved to Los Angeles and got fired from Checkers Hotel.
Oh, okay. I didn't know about that.
Yeah. And then, now let's just, can someone find the F&B director that fired?
Yeah, Scully? What's that guy doing now? I mean, he's working at a Popeyes. This is like, order in three burgers.
I would love to meet that guy and go, so what were you thinking? So,
he just didn't have any talent.
I mean,
can you imagine?
He's probably like playing cards with the guy who traded Babe Ruth.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're all together.
But so he got fired from Checkers. He was living at Peter Michael's guest house, doing catering, peddling some olive oil, trying to put together the French Laundry, and so there was a lot of, I guess you'd call it failure, before he got to be where he is, and because of that, I think that made him such a better leader and a better chef, and he really understood what he was doing. I mean, no one talks about that, but that really added to the experience.
Did that resonate with you when you yourself met some challenges in passing the Master Sommelier exam? Because it was a little bit there for you. Did you have that? I mean, did you kind of bro down on that with him? You're like, yeah, I kind of feel like this is difficult for me, and I feel stronger getting through it.
Yeah, and Thomas definitely pushes you to go after.
Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, he's a competitive guy. If he has Bobby working for him, he wants Bobby to push himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing is, like, the MS program was a challenge for myself. It wasn't because I wanted my resume to look better. It didn't. I already had a great job.
Yeah.
I was wine director of the French Laundry.
I mean, two great jobs in a row. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't need the MS program to do that. The MS program was my own personal journey. And a lot of people used to give me a hard time. Like, they're like, Bobby, you keep failing. Why don't you just walk away?
Right.
You'd won a James Beard Award in 2001. You're at the French Laundry. Why don't you just, like, quietly quit doing that MS deal?
Because you were kind of the Susan Lucci of the MS program.
Oh, my God.
For a second there.
For a long second, you know. And I was like, wait a second. I'm not going to quit something because someone tells me I should. I'm going to do it because I want that challenge. And I think it made me a better sommelier. Well, for one reason, if you have to study that theory, pass that theory exam twice, you're going to be even stronger because you know what you're up against. So when you go into, they call it resetting, when you have to give up your parts and start again from scratch.
Oh, okay.
And it made me a stronger person to have to do that.
So you have to take all of the parts of the exam again.
So what you do is, let's say someone right here, a friend of ours, passes tasting. They have two more visits at the exam to pass theory and service.
Got it.
If they don't, they have to what's called reset. And then you have to give up those parts and go back to square one. It's a really humbling experience. It sucks. And I remember the day I had to give up my parts. It was interesting. There was a not-to-be-named MS came out, and all he had to do is get through service. And he came out and stayed with me and worked with me at the French Laundry to kind of get honed up on his service skills.
Oh, to kind of help each other out. Yeah.
And he passed, and I failed and had to give up my parts, and I was just like, so, I mean, it was deflating. And then at that time, you could go take it in London. So, like, I just said, okay, I'm just going to, I took 2 weeks off and then went right back to study. And my wife's like, what, are we doing this again? And went back, got service and theory again, and then it took me a year and to get through tasting. But, yeah.
But I think, you did do it.
Yeah.
You got it.
Yeah.
You didn't give up. You're there, and you passed the MS, you got it, and then you make a decision to get closer to your wife's family in Colorado.
Yeah. So Lachlan and I knew we wanted to do a restaurant. Of course, you look at the San Francisco because you're living there. We briefly looked at places like Portland and other spots, but lifestyle-wise, and Danette's mom had passed away when we were at the laundry, and her dad was living in Golden. And her brother and sister live out there too. And we thought, you know, this is a tough business. Let's live close to him, and then we can, you know, be able to see him and things like that. And Dick is his name. I would think I'd see a lot more of Dick than I do. When we see him, it's great. But I thought I'd see him, like, in the restaurant, like once a week.
Yeah, all the time, yeah.
And it's maybe once a month or twice a month. But so we decided to move out there. And really, Lachlan and I looked at Denver, but lifestyle-wise, we just resonated with Boulder more.
And this was someone that had worked, as you said, on the line at the French Laundry that you believed in, and you're like, hey, we could go be a team together.
Yeah.
But what you did was very different, because instead of building a global list, you went more regional.
Yeah. I mean, we have a little bit of other stuff on the list. I mean, there's a little bit of a small amount of California. There's a little Burgundy. It's funny. We really think as a wine team about Austria more than we do the rest of Italy for white wine. Like if you're in Friuli and you drink 13.5-14% alcohol Colio Friulano, that resonates and has a more of a through line tether than Vahau Gruner than it does Suave from next door in the Veneto.
I can see that.
And so we do have a fair amount of Austria wine on there because, you know, Friuli was for, I don't know, a small time period, 400 years, part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. And I think that the cuisine there resonates with those wines also.
That makes a lot of sense.
So we definitely are, we always say we think of Friuli first, Northern Italy second, and then the rest of the world. So
did you find that was somewhat unique going regional at that time in an era where people are doing a little bit more like pan-Italian?
Yes. It was interesting. I'm looking at the A16 book over here.
Yeah, there you go.
They opened the same. We opened within a few months of each other.
You told me one time you looked at that space. At one
oh,
point.
Yeah, I
like
did.
You and almost opened in that spot.
Well, I wasn't as like, I didn't, not a a visionary like Shelley. Like Shelley saw that space and made it great.
Mm-hmm.
Like I saw that space and like turned around and started sprinting the other way. I
mean, like,
I didn't
no
have,
way.
I mean, it was really dark and closed in, and she added her juju to it, which is, it's been phenomenal.
Well, the skylight in the back really opens it up, I think, all the way in the back.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Because it is a long kind of,
yeah,
like train station kind of length.
Yeah, and she has great energy in there. But we opened the same time period, and you know, she did Campania and we did Friuli. So we always joke that we're like cousins.
Yeah.
And there wasn't, especially in Colorado, there was nothing like that. No one like, I mean, I remember our first wait staff were so shell-shocked because, you know, it's interesting. If you go to France and you go live in Paris for a year or two, you still don't ever feel like you're like a Parisian expert,
mm-hmm,
right? Because,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
But Italy, if you go to Tuscany for your honeymoon for a week,
sure.
20 years later, you still think you're an Italian expert.
And why do you think that is? Do you think that's because the bar is somewhat low? Like that's the people around you is the, like if you went to Tuscany, that was kind of a big deal. Whereas maybe it's more obvious because of the institutions that France has all this culture, or I mean, why do we?
I think we think resonate that with Italy more because Italy lets you.
Mm-hmm.
They
uh-huh.
open the door. I mean, if it's amazing, like Italian people let that door in. So what happens though is you become Italy. People don't realize that Italy is so diversified. So if you go to Tuscany on a trip and then Rome on a trip, that's what you think Italy is, and then you go eat at a Friulano restaurant. You're kind of a little fussy.
Yeah.
At first, you're like, well, what's going on? Like, what's Frico?
Right.
Well, what is this? And so at first, when we first opened, it was really hard on the wait staff to try to communicate to people, yes, you're in an Italian restaurant, but it's a Friulano restaurant. And that was really, and we worked really hard to make sure our staff understood that culture inside and out, you know.
And what worked for you? I mean, one of the things that seems so amazing about your place is that you would take people there. Your staff, you take like the whole staff there.
Yeah, five times we've taken, closed the restaurant, taken the whole staff. So, I mean, we've taken a dishwasher that once he had the ability to have citizenship, we took a dishwasher who had never been on an airplane before to Friuli.
How many screams? Like,
he had a lot of rosaries. So he
was, right.
Feeling those rosaries, a couple mezcals. He was like, a little Clos de Bets.
Yeah, you're like, Bobby, or you're like, Richard, I got a job for you. I need a doctor.
We need to help him out here.
Dr. Sombra needs to come make a house call.
But so we did that, and we still have people over there often. So like this year we had someone work at Ronca de Nemitz for Harvest. We had a sous chef over there last month documenting a bunch of dishes for a dinner we were doing. So we always try to get people over there with us because they need to understand what Friuli is about.
And do you find locally that the understanding of that is built? I mean, my understanding is you run popular restaurants. Like people are digging it, or
you know, it's really, it's awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel so gratified. Like, how many people now know of Friuli through Boulder, Colorado?
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, we have a document we sent out that if someone called me and they're like, "Hey, Bobby, we're going to Friuli," and I email them this document we did. It really lets someone get a 3 to a 5 or a week vacation done in Friuli. No hitches, like where to have coffee at a certain time, where to eat on Tuesday, where to eat pesce crudo at the Mare, where to eat frico. And so now, like, we have a community that really loves going, that have gone there. It's great. We just did our touchstone restaurant is a place called La Subida. It's in outside of Cormans in Friuli, in the Colio. And we had that family come do a dinner with us at Frasca. It was like the pinnacle of what we've done. Like, have these guys come and do a menu with us. And it was just wild to see the dining room that night of people that were had on their calendar to go there or had already gone there. It was wild. And I was like, I would have never thought 9 years ago I would fill a whole dining room of people that have either were going that year or had already been in the last couple of years to Friuli, into this restaurant.
It seems like one of the things you did was realize that, you know, if you just stayed in the dining room in Colorado, it wasn't going to work. So you had to get out, take the staff to trips to Italy, but also work with other restaurants and do dinners. Like, mm-hmm. you know, go to SPQR, do a dinner there. Go to 11 Madison Park, do a dinner there. Has that been helpful for you in kind of like building that culture of Friuli lovers in America?
Oh, for sure. And that, and also having them out to see us. I mean, mm-hmm. it's great for us to have these guest chefs, you know, once a quarter come do something with us at Frasca, because at the end of the day, we want Colorado. Yes, we're in Boulder, but we're part of the Denver metro area. Have them have this access to maybe a chef that they didn't get a chance to go to on their last trip to New York, or they're not going to New York for a while. So if you're a young culinarian, you're a line chef, you know, we try to make it as affordable as possible so you could take your night off from a great restaurant in Denver and come up even as a line chef and eat the food of Daniel Hume or Matthew Acarino or whoever we have in there. And that's really important, and it's really helped us grow as a restaurant too.
And you've had a history of developing wine talent as well at the restaurant. I mean, there have been quite a few notable people have come through helping you on the wine side at the restaurant. I know you have obviously a love of wine and you worked as a sommelier, but what else do you think has allowed you to, in a venue that's, you know, has a national profile but isn't maybe the first things a young sommelier thinks of doing? Like, hey, I'm going to move to Boulder and work with Italian wine. Like, what are the attributes do you think lend so many successes to what you've done on the wine side with people?
Well, we have been really lucky. We've had some great, just fantastic people come through our program. It'd be Jesse Becker. I mean, obviously, Dustin Wilson.
Sure, of EMP.
Yeah. I mean, phenomenal. Sir Lucero. There's a lot of people that have come through. But I don't think it's, I think it's a combination of a couple things. One, it was so hard for me to get through the MS.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's easier for me to coach now.
Sure. Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
And then also, I don't think we are dogmatic about, okay, you're going to come here and become an MS,
mm-hmm.
or you're expected, or it's all laid out for you. But there's an encouraging environment that if you want to do that, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has to be a self-starter. I think we've been really lucky to have a lot of self-starters come through too. I mean, you also get those people that come through who don't succeed, where they think, oh, I'm working at Frasca, I'm just going to instantly pass my advanced level. No.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, it takes people's inner drive to...
Yeah. Just because you get accepted to Harvard doesn't mean you're getting your Nobel.
Or, yeah, exactly.
Do something. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think part of it is our environment. One thing we do do is Lachlan, you know, Lachlan doesn't get enough credit for this, but he's a chef that's way into wine.
Is that true? I didn't know that.
It's not, you know, I mean, the joke is, I don't know if you heard people saying this yesterday, where's the collector? That's the joke of like what Raj and Eric Railsback and Dustin, that's what we all call Lachlan.
Oh, okay.
So he's a chef that's like really into wine.
Because that's actually kind of rare.
Super rare.
I mean, a lot of people have an interest but don't really follow it up. Maybe because they don't have the time or money, yeah, like on the chef side.
Yeah, and it's hard for chefs to say, hey, I want to like really respect what the front of the house is doing and get to know what they're doing. So Lachlan and I have this approach like, you know, we will buy wine that has nothing to do with our program so people can blind taste.
Oh, okay, okay.
So they get a sponsored tasting group out of us.
Got it.
You know, and that I think that helps a lot too. Because it's expensive to study, to hone your palate, to become a great taster.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the big barriers to entry for younger people who weren't part of your generation, my generation, where things were just kind of open all the time and the economy was booming and things were just happening. You know what I mean? Now it's a little bit like, well, that costs a lot of money and I don't see the bottles open. You know what I mean? For young guys, I think it's difficult. I talk to a lot of people who have not tried certain things. So I'm like, oh. And I try not to say it in a way that's like kind of shocking, but I'm always sort of surprised. But then I realize, well, of course you haven't because it's expensive now and, you know.
Yeah, and then they don't have a context.
Right.
And if you don't taste something, you don't have a context. I mean, it's interesting. Like I ate the other night with Richard over in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
And we had a nice time, and we had a great time. But it's interesting when you look at wine lists over there, there's probably a lot of wine buyers over there that they haven't drank maybe some of the – they don't have an experience tasting really well-made California Cabernet. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, if you said that, they'd be like, what?
Right, yeah.
There is such a thing? Yeah. You know, I mean, I've heard that.
Right. Well, and I saw an altercation last night, actually, at La Palle about that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. About just that subject. Like, people come in different angles on that right now. You know? Like, some people are like, there's good things. And then other people are like, no. And that's...
Oh, wow. That's
I think in New York, you know. I tried to get in between, but there was
was it pretty hot in heaven?
There was too much drinking involved already. I tried.
Oh, wow.
I was like, guys, let's circle back to Burgundy, huh? Look, Grand Cruz. I had to leave.
Oh, man. So what was it? Someone like saying, oh, there's nothing
to
do in
California? You get a bunch of guys in the wine business together and strong opinions happen. You know what I mean?
Like that is intense.
But you get your East Coast, West Coast. You know, it's like Tupac and Biggie. You know, it's really, that stuff never goes away.
Yeah.
It just manifests itself in different styles, you know?
Yeah. Like, oh, I mean, I think there's a lot of really exciting things going on in California right now.
I agree with you 100%. I was just out there, you know? I mean, the energy that I see there reminds me of like the energy of movements that are starting, like with Arno Roberts or you know, I like Skolium Project a lot. I like Abe a lot. I mean, here's the thing with Abe. I mean, it's amazing. He really is like the Pied Piper. I mean, he does a lecture, 80 people show up.
Yeah.
If I did a lecture on Freud, Aristotle, and how that related to Soldera, I mean, my mom maybe might call in and ask me how it was going. I don't think 80 people will come.
Yeah.
I witnessed it. These people paid money.
Wow.
I was like, well, this is nuts. Like, people are paying to hear about how Homeric hymns line up with microbes and wine. I mean, what? What did you just say? Like, this is something that people pay money for?
Yeah.
People just want to be around him. Like, people just want to soak that up. That kind of thing is powerful. That's not going somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? That's going somewhere. So, I think.
And you know what? I wish I would have heard this conversation yesterday that you got to witness.
Ah, shucks. Oh, the one, yes. You could have jumped right in there. You're like, you got the crib notes. You're like, debater number one.
Yeah. But, you know, I think about it. There's some things about California, and this is going to be sacrilegious to say this sitting in Manhattan today. But there's some things about California winemaking that's actually ahead of some of the things going on in Europe.
What would be examples of that for you?
Well, for example, I was in Paris last year. Danette and I were there on vacation. And, you know, to be a sommelier, to understand the wine, you also have to understand the winemaking, really, especially when things have, like, really shifts in winemaking style. So, you know, we have this big natural wine movement, you know? We have this crazy natural wine movement. And the thing is, some of the young wine buyers, if it be in Paris, if it be in Milan, if it be in New York, Chicago, they don't have enough context yet in their tasting, and they're really embracing some flaws.
A movement more than
that. Yeah. And they're embracing these flaws in wine. And the winemakers in Europe are doing the same thing. So, for example, what I was going to use as an example is like, so we were there for like 5 days in Paris, eating all over, and then we left and then came back. And every night we went out, it was like, and my wife's really, really sweet, but she'll tell me like, Bobby, are we going to drink a sound wine?
Is that really? Yeah. Well, she's tough.
Yeah.
She's a tough palate.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If yeah, she's like, you know, you got to serve her a good wine.
Yeah. She's like, are we going to drink anything sound tonight? Because every night you had these young Parisian sommeliers going, oh, have you had this or had that? And the funny thing is, I actually had someone serve me a macerated wine from Alsace.
Oh, okay. Oh, boy, you know, not so many of those.
No.
Was that like Beaner or something?
It was Bayer. It was a wine from Bayer. And, And it was, the sommelier didn't know what was going on with it.
Oh, okay.
And he didn't know who I was, and he didn't know that, like, I have a restaurant based on Friuli that actually knows a little bit about macerated wines. And
Sure. You've seen that movement happen in that region.
And what was interesting was he didn't understand it, and I don't think the winemaker who he bought the wine from understood it, because the winemaker probably had never been to Friuli to ask those questions.
Sure.
The interesting thing about the movement in California is a lot of those people pushing the envelope also travel.
Yeah, I think that's really distinctive about the new wave of California. They got out of Napa.
Yeah.
They got out of Dodge.
They've either gone and done stages places. The wine world got smaller for them. There's a lot of Napa, California winemakers that I've talked to about Friuli that have been there.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
Because it's not so common with Americans to go to Friuli.
No, but but that scene, and a lot of it because of Abe. You know, Abe's been going to Friuli for 15 years.
Is that true? I didn't know that.
Well, because he was at Luna.
He was into... Oh, right. He was... Right.
So Luna, John Conscar, people don't know this. I remember they did a partly macerated Pinot Grigio in 99 or 98.
I remember that wine.
So he was like really... John Conscar was like a big Raticon fan. He's great friends with Grauner. He knows all the people.
He says it right. I'll make a note that he says it right. Maybe the only man in America who says the pronunciation right.
Oh, of Grauner?
Yeah.
That's how you say it.
I know. I'm making a note of this. I'm saying it's not so many people you see who say it correctly.
Yeah. But you know, and so Abe really was into that too. And Abe goes there often still, you know. So there's a lot of people there that have gone and seen that, and I think that really helps California winemaking.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're really right that is unique, because you go to a lot of European regions, and still today, you know, they may be to neighboring regions, but they haven't often been around the world.
Yeah.
And to different... I mean, sometimes they'll do a stage in New Zealand or something, but quite often it is still a little bit more, for good or for ill, a little more homespun, a little bit more local. I mean, I don't want to go back in time and have Barlow get on the Concorde and travel around the world, you know? Like, I'm happy he stayed just who he was.
For sure.
But in other realms, I'm like, wow, that's interesting that you could look at it that way. I think it's really important, too, for, like, developing regions. You know, I was talking to Tegan the other day, Pascalacqua, who's for Turley, and he's a guy who's traveled a lot. And, you know, he kind of looks at the potential of Lodi through the lens of global, because so when you're defining what a region could be, I think it's helpful to have like global ideas in place as opposed to just what has happened there previously.
Yes.
When it's still trying to find its niche, when it hasn't been 100 years, or I mean, I guess it really has been 100 years, but 100 years of really honed production. You know what I mean?
Well, for sure. I mean, look what happened to Tuscany.
Sure.
Tuscany 42 years ago, Gianfranco Soldera pretty much got the casa, you know, got his estate for what, a tax deduction. I mean, it was like nothing. He got it for nothing. But it was people in Tuscany realizing, with really like the thought process in the 80s, the Sangiovese 2000 project, where they said, wait a second, we can have great Sangiovese here in Tuscany. We don't have to have, we don't need the Merlot or Cabernet to make it great. But what did they have to do? They had to look outside of Tuscany, realize, wait, the Sangiovese clones that we might be planting are not the best for this vineyard. Plant the right things, the right density, and now we can drink really, really great Sangiovese with no makeup. But it took looking out. I mean, really, in a weird way, it's sacrilegious to say this, but Tuscany was an emerging wine region.
No doubt. Yeah, 40 absolutely.
People don't realize this. 40 years ago, in 1966, there were less Brunello producers than there were producers in Napa Valley.
No, absolutely.
And it took, they had to emerge.
And in a way, still are. With the recent, you know, grape variety ideas and, you know, maybe trying to change it. You know, some people want to change it and have more than just Sangiovese in there. And, you know, it's still a conversation in a way, you know. I mean, I guess it's always a conversation. Like, even in Burgundy, like, hey, maybe we'll do Pinot Fin.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's not always a set thing. But, you know, I guess that's what keeps us in business. Because otherwise, you know, if there was no change from vintage to vintage, I'd, you know, what would I be doing?
Exactly.
You
know what I mean? I mean, and look at things. Like, look how much Piedmont has improved.
Isn't it nice where we are right now?
It's awesome.
I mean, just opening up all ones, I'm pretty happy. You know what I mean? Like 10 years on, 11 years on. But then going tasting it out of barrel, you're like, wow. Or Bode, you know what I mean? But like, well, this is good. You guys are hitting it. I mean, not everybody. It's a big place. But a lot of people, you know.
And really improved. And you don't have to use the word traditional. Or you can be a Piemontese geek and love it all.
Well, there's a lot of flux on that. What we would have called a firm divide maybe 10 years ago. You know what I mean? There's a lot of people going back one way or other, increasing, decreasing.
Yeah.
You know, I think.
And it's amazing tasting some of those wines from the O1s and tasting them and seeing that back, because that was when it was raging. But there's some really well-made wine that we didn't know was that great and made 11 years ago, 12 years ago. And you open up the bottle now, you're like, wow, fantastic.
So for as long as I've known you, you've been a very measured, I think very responsible, and always set a good example. But we're going to ask you to do the opposite. What are some of the things that have frustrated you over the course of what you've seen with wine and then with your own restaurant? I mean, let me ask you, is it frustrating not to get the attention sometimes that maybe a New York restaurant of even maybe lesser caliber than what you do would get? I mean, what is frustrating to you about some of those changes in wine styles? I mean, if you could just alter the map in some way and be like, you know, that would be nice if it weren't like that. What would those things be?
So, meaning wine style wise, what do I wish was different?
Yeah, or just your own career as a restaurateur. I mean, what's frustrating to you? I remember one time you said, you know what, we have such great coffee at our restaurant, and no, we never get credit for it. It's incredibly great coffee, and no one ever says, hey, Frasca. I mean, do those things happen for you?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I will speak to that, and I'm going to get in trouble for doing this. Pete Wells put that piece out. He was really upset about the beard nominations.
Sure. Yeah, recently, where he said, you know, look, there's no New York restaurants on this list.
Which is unfortunate, because in a way, he had a point that there were some great restaurants that should have been on that list. Now, we don't know who's going to come out nominated because it's a long list. But look, there were also some years where there was, like, if you look back through the ballots, and, you know, no one can really call up Pete and say, you're wrong. I mean, you get in a lot of trouble. I'm going to get in trouble right now. But if you look at, like,
from the five people who listen to this show.
So. But if you look at 2005, I think it was James Beard Foundation nominees for Best New Restaurant. That was a year Michael Mina opened. Cyrus Michelin. It's closed, but it was a Michelin 2-star restaurant. A16 opened. We opened. Some great restaurants in Chicago. A lot of great restaurants opened. There was not one non-New York restaurant.
Is that true, really?
Yeah.
In the nominations? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was like... there's great restaurants on there. I mean, I think you had Crew was on there. You had Spotted Pig. It was Crew, Spotted Pig, Spice Market.
Sure. Well, it was such a hot opening. I don't know if you weren't around New York at that time, but God, everybody wanted to go down there. I mean, working at Danielle, it was like you were calling, asking if you could make reservations for guests. Like, hey, any chance you could get me a couple seats? Oh, no, not tonight. Oh, come on, man. I thought we were friends.
That's right.
Sorry to interrupt.
So going back to that, it's like, yeah, that's tough for the rest of America.
Yeah.
That,
I mean, a place like Cyrus maybe could have used that help. I mean,
for sure.
You know,
and also if you look at like landscape changers, I mean, A16 should have been on that list, you know? Yeah. Landscape changer. Michael Mino, awesome restaurant. Definitely had an argument to be on that list.
Making kind of an even different kind of format of menu. I remember he was doing the like different plays off of things.
And variations and all that. So that does happen in the U.S. It's like, it's kind of weird here. Because like if you're in France, if you're in Italy, if you're in Austria, you can be a great restaurant in the middle of the country. Forever it's been that way. If you think about...
Bra, for sure.
I mean, I've been there, man. And I ate there. I actually, Thomas Keller took me there.
That was cool.
Awesome.
Do you guys eat together a lot? I mean, was that a thing?
He would take a couple of us. Yeah, I mean, it was awesome. Like, I mean, that meal was fantastic.
Was that kind of a model for you? Like, to take people out?
Well, that definitely gave me an idea. I was like, I got so much of going to Europe with Thomas.
That's
like,
great.
You know?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was great.
I mean, knowing you for a while, we're not close. We don't hang out all the time. But I never hear you talk about him. So I actually don't know what your relationship with him was like. You know what I mean? Like, just never come up.
Like, I mean, that was a defining moment. You need to go eat at a couple. He took me to the Fat. He took Danette and I to the Fat Duck. And
oh, okay.
It was.
Did you meet Ruben Sanz Romero?
No.
He worked there for a while.
Did he?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a short period, though. He hurt his back, so he had to leave the job. It was kind of unfortunate. But
oof.
I mean, he's doing great now. So.
Yeah. I mean, it was. That was great stuff. But if you think about Europe, you can be the greatest restaurant in that country, not in Paris.
Sure.
Or in Italy, you can be Del Pescatore in the middle of nowhere.
Sure.
How journalism is laid out in this country, that's not going to happen. Matter of fact, you know, when I worked at the French Laundry, I used to, you know, as a sommelier, you hear everything, right?
Yeah,
you're the guy pouring wine.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And I would hear these great chefs eat at the French Laundry before he had Per Se, and they're like, you actually think he'd get 4 stars in New York? Really? You think so?
Yeah, people always talk smack until the stars arrive.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Then it's accepted wisdom.
Yeah.
But until then, they're like, oh, I don't think so. But you know what I mean?
Yeah. that's like, what people would do.
People do it all the time.
So I think it's, this is going to be hard to say, but I think it's harder to be a restaurateur outside of a major market because you have to work so much harder. It's not conventional wisdom, but going back to the coffee deal.
Yeah.
We, 8 years ago, I mean, what are you doing if you're in an Italian restaurant? You got to pull a great espresso shot. You've got to polish your glassware. You got to bust your table. You got to slice prosciutto and roll out pasta. If you aren't doing those things, I don't care who you are, you're not a good restaurant. Well, 8, 9 years ago, if you came to New York and ordered an espresso in most restaurants, what would it be like?
It would be like that brand that starts with an L that I don't want to get a lot of trouble for. And it
yeah.
would be like in the cup with that brand on it.
Yeah.
like and it would at with great no crema. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it would be a guy who has no barista training.
Right.
Back with the espresso machine.
Miguel.
Yeah.
2 orders. Yeah.
Okay.
And the guy's like extra packing it. Remember extra pack?
Yeah.
Like, oh, let's put more in there. Like,
yeah.
Remember that?
Because totally.
I used to be that guy.
Yeah.
And you're like,
you know, and but that was coffee in a New York Times 3-star restaurant not that long ago.
Right.
But if, you know, here you are, just a little simple thing like that. If you're working so hard, you never get any credit for that. No one, like, they couldn't even imagine. Wait, is there actually someone doing something that we should be doing here?
Right.
But like also, journalists don't want to get into that speak because they want New York to be number one.
Yeah.
And then you can play around with Chicago and, but I mean,
those are ducats. Give out some ducats.
Yeah. But those are things that are, those are basic tasks and those need to be done. And that's what makes a restaurant good.
And do you think that you kind of surmounted that by building it locally, by kind of communicating your message locally and then having that kind of filter out? Or how did you surmount that? Because you have a national reputation now. I mean, obviously you came with a national reputation for yourself. I mean, that couldn't have hurt. But now people know Frasca. People think of Pizzeria Locale. So do you think you beat that system by building the local base? Or what did you do?
Well, I wasn't trying to beat anybody. I was just trying to be the best restaurant person I could be. And I wanted my staff to be the best restaurant people we could be.
I'm not hating the player. I'm hating the game.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you beat the system?
Well,
how
did
you break Vegas?
Oh, so what we did is we just did our own thing consistently every night.
Yeah.
And as long as, I mean, you got to work really hard if you're in a town of 80,000 people to be busy 9 years later, 8 years later. And so our goal was, how are we going to make this the best neighborhood restaurant in the world? Okay. And we talk about that. Like we got to pull, it's all these basics. You got to do those things first. And then you can do something else. And I think when we were doing it, and we do it every day still, we're not doing it because we want to have national press. We're doing it because that guest coming in needs to have a great espresso shot.
Sure.
That guest coming in needs to drink delicious wine. That guest coming in needs to have a pasta that they couldn't do at home. That's
was there a fealty to what you'd had as an experience in Italy? Did you say like, you know, this doesn't deliver on what we were eating there and we need to be true to that? Was that part of the drive?
Well, actually, I thought part of the drive, I mean, Lachlan and I talk about this a lot with our team, is that we want to take a dish or take a style of service, if it be making coffee, if it be decanting wine, if it be whatever, and contemporize it and make it a little bit better.
Got it.
So if we're working every day for the rest of our career, hopefully 100 years from now, two things are going to happen. I'm going to have Danette's shoe collection paid off. And two, we're going to be a much better restaurant than we started at. I mean, that's something that's kind of weird here in America. Like here, we want to build out the restaurant, hire the best designer, and go for that first review, and then maybe be peaked.
Right, and then kind of forget about it after.
Yeah, think about the great restaurants in the world that inspire me. Let's say Michel Bra. I mean, that guy started as like, it was a bar down in La Jolla.
And then I did not know that.
Yeah, his mom had a bar. He was a chef. Or Del Pescatore in Northern Italy. I mean, that restaurant was like a fish fry place. It's one of the pinnacles of great pasta production you can see anywhere because it's not a leveraged restaurant program. Leveraged meaning taking a bunch of either investors or whatever, building this temple out and then riding it from there. It's a building program. And that's kind of what inspires us too.
Bobby, if you could talk to a young sommelier that you haven't met, someone who hasn't had the opportunity to meet you, what would you say to that person? Because we get a lot of young sommeliers listening to the show. If you could just give them a little bit of advice, core principles, or just specifics, what would you reach out and help them with?
Maybe the first thing is, are you a great waiter? Because everyone wants to go from like, get into the restaurant business to the MS program. You got to wait tables. And so if you're waiting tables, you're becoming a good hospitality person. So, you know, hospitality is key. So humility and listening and empathy, those are all things that you need to be a great long-term sommelier. And empathy because you need to understand what that guest is going through. If they just drove up, like if you're in Boulder, if they just drove up through rush hour to eat at Frasca at 6 o'clock on a Friday night and they got there on time, we have to be empathetic to that. They just drove through a snowstorm. As a sommelier, you need to do that. You got to be a good listener because it's not about your night. Your night off is Sunday night and you can do whatever you want on Sunday night. But those other 5 or 6 nights a week you're on the floor, it's all about the guests, period. And I think sometimes we forget that in our industry. We're like, they think it's about themselves. And mm-hmm. It's so not. Because it's got to be, you know, you got to care about the guests and be okay with things that take time. You know, everyone wants to, like, do it all at once. You can't taste that much wine to become great all at once. You know, you got to let it happen.
Come on, Bobby. What if they put it all in the same glass? Hey, Bobby, you've been a big inspiration to me from afar. I always appreciate what you're about and your whole thing. And I dig you a lot, and I appreciate taking the time to be on the show.
Thanks so much.
Bobby Stuckey of Frasca Food and Wine and also Pizzeria Locale in Colorado. Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot.
The exclusive sponsor of I'll Drink to That is 750, a powerful and easy-to-use online search tool for wholesale buyers of wine and spirits in New York and New Jersey. 750 incorporates over 100 distributor portfolios and a number of unique features that make the lives of buyers simpler and more productive. I'll Drink to That is recorded with the great assistance of executive producer Matt Ducker and also with the great help of our guests and listeners. Thank you for joining us. You can catch us online, alldrinktothatpod.com, no apostrophe, alldrinktothatpod.com, or on Twitter at drinktothatpod. And you can find us on iTunes. You should subscribe. Tell us what you think in a review. Subscribe on iTunes. Thank you for listening.